Ladies and gentlemen, storytellers of all ages, lend your ears to co-hosts Brad and Philip as we delve into the Marketing Your Attraction podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Your Attraction podcast. This is episode 20. I'm your host, Brad, and I'm joined by Philip. I can't believe we made it to 20 episodes.
I know. I feel like there should be a sound cue that comes in right now. That's like,
exactly. Woo! Yes. Now, many podcasts I listen to have made it to 500 episodes.
And, that's true.
I don't know if we'll make it to 500.
We'll keep going.
I'll let you know in 10 years or whatever it is.
Hey, you know, we finally got the website up. For anyone that's been following, there's a new website up and we're making posts of all the old content. So you can look through it and all the new stuff is on there. It's pretty nice, pretty nifty.
Yeah, Philip and his team did an amazing, amazing job on it. And it's responsive. It has all the podcast archives up there, all of the blogs, as Philip mentioned. And we're just going to keep adding more and more content to that. So you can find that at marketingyourattraction.com. Speaking of milestones, I have some big news this week that I'll just quickly touch on. I just left Knott's Berry Farm after 4 years. My last day was on Friday, July 13th. So Friday the 13th, how fitting, right? And it's definitely bittersweet, you know, after 4 years of learning and growing there and working on incredible projects from opening new rides and roller coasters to helping launch the first Boysenberry Festival. So many fond memories of the park and of the team. I just had to make a change to kind of take the next step in my career. So I'm joining Razer. They're a gaming hardware company. They do gaming hardware and software out here in Southern California. Make everything from cutting edge laptops to headphones. They make Android phone, crazy light up keyboards, like everything that gamers need. So I'll be joining Razer as a marketing manager there. Don't worry, I'm not leaving the podcast, which is a good or bad thing, right? Depending on if you're a big fan of Philip and you're like, I just wanted more Philip, what to do with the podcast? And I'm also probably going to be doing a little bit of consulting in the attractions industry as well, which I'm excited about. Don't have anything to announce right now, but I am talking to a couple people about doing a few smaller projects. You know, my main focus will continue to be on my day job at Razer. But I think there might be an opportunity or two to work on seasonal attractions, which I'm really excited about. So moving on from that news, I had a little bit of free time this week since my job was ending at Knott's, and I had a couple of free days there. I finally updated my blog, so I just wanted to quickly mention that because I think there's a couple of interesting articles on there, because I think they're interesting. The first one actually appeared in Philip's Seasonal Attractions magazine that came out last month. And we mentioned this, I think, on episode 2 of the podcast. And the whole article talks about elevating moments into lasting memories. So we took that podcast conversation that Philip and I did, and I turned it into a blog. And Philip's team kind of helped me edit it. And so there's sort of a preview, or 90% of that article is on my blog. And in the coming weeks or so, it'll be on the Seasonal Attractions magazine website as well, with a lot more content on there. But that link will be on in the show notes. And I also finished writing an article about how my team at Knott's and myself worked on live streaming from the new Hangtime roller coaster. We did this back in May, and I finally had a chance to upload all the photos and kind of write about that whole process of how do you live stream wirelessly from a roller coaster that is going 57 miles per hour, 150 feet in the air. It was quite a challenge, and a lot of problem solving with a ton of smart people from multiple departments at Knott's and outside contractors. So that's a quick little read if you're interested on how the professionals, you know, quote unquote, the professionals get really high quality video on media days. I kind of give a behind the scenes preview of that. So you can find both of those. Links are in the show notes. My website is bradjashinsky.com. Last name's not the easiest to spell, so check the show notes for links to that. So Philip, I've been dominating the first section of our news and our quick takes. I want to send it over to you because I know you have a bunch of news and quick takes you wanted to talk about this week as well.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to jump right in with this article from entrepreneur.com. It's called Changing the Game, Socialize Founder Goel on the Evolution of Her Digital Media. It's an interesting article. I don't know how, like, you know, how much I agree with it. It's just very interesting because I'll read a quote here, but her whole brand is on like working with brands specifically with their social. I'm going to read this explanation of strategy. Goel reveals its strategy to be something she calls art plus science. It stands for thumb stopping creative. In a region where people spend so much time on mobile, a brand's content message story needs to stand out while the audience is scrolling. Our creative team specializes in creating this content that is built for the mobile newsfeed. Science stands for innovative media, harnessing the power of real-time social data to target audiences with military precision, allowing personalized messages to be seen by the right people at scale, driving measurable business growth for clients. So what I don't like about it is that there's a lot in here that is, it's very buzzword. Like a few things that she said here were interesting. This part, finding the intersection between the appropriate message and the ideal platform is key. And the most personal platform we have is mobile, especially in a region that has moved to mobile at record speed and spends more time with social networking apps. At Socialize, we help brands leverage social platforms and tools effectively. Why this was interesting, and I wish they had pulled it out a little bit more. She has a few tips at the bottom. You guys can go read through. It's a long article to say basically their brand specializes in creating reactions on mobile platforms, like versus which is interesting because like she had this before the Facebook newsfeed algorithm changed, and then obviously their stuff has expanded and she kind of has that kind of niche cornered, because that's what we're seeing, right? Is we're seeing now social is about people interacting with each other. So her brand specializes in using, basically they create creative that facilitates interaction between customers on a brand's social platform. So long story short, that's what they do. And her stuff is very much in like theory land, and I wish it would come down into some examples, but there are a few tips she gives you, but it's just interesting that now there are whole firms that are like pivoting, kind of in the wake of the Facebook alteration. Let's see. And Brad, you had one with museums to tie in a little bit to my other articles.
Yeah, just this was on the cover of the Fun World magazine, which is the official magazine from IAPA, the attractions industry trade group. And it was talking about how museums are looking for, you know, new ways to enhance guest visits and also draw on different types of guests. And the main story was talking about how museums are using their spaces for different yoga classes and other exercise classes and all sorts of, you know, different ways to use that space to kind of make it more alive and attract, you know, people that may or may not necessarily have visited that museum before, kind of taking what you would think would happen in a museum and completely turning it on its head and attracting a bunch of new guests who not only get to experience these wellness classes, but then also get to learn more about the museum and hopefully become regular visitors. If you're not reading Fun World, I definitely recommend it. They always have interesting articles and news that you don't usually find at other places. They tend to do kind of deeper dives. I'm always impressed by their content.
I like that because it really ties in. I have a few quick news items here. One I didn't listen here, but is the new wedding spot opening up at Animal Kingdom. Like you can have your wedding in front of the Tree of Life. And the other is the Disney World holiday plans. They've announced more about their holiday plans here and at Toy Story Land and an Up show. And then Alton Towers is expanding with camping pods, like 102 camping pods they're going to put there for extra guests to stay. It says each pod will have a double bed and two singles, as well as electricity with communal shower and toilet blocks elsewhere. So like literally just like sleeping pods and then like communal showers and toilets. So if you take all this together, it's sort of interesting, an interesting trend where you see, like, I think it's good, but it's interesting of attractions utilizing their spaces for like reframing the purpose for their space. You know, like, well, we're not using the Tree of Life in the morning, so people always like to take pictures in front of it. You know, you can have a wedding there. And, you know, guests want to come to Alton Towers, but, you know, some of them want a little extra layer to their experience, and, you know, we don't want them staying at hostels or whatever. So we'll make like camping pods, and the whole family can like camp together for really cheap and be able to come in and have that. And then these seasonal items. So there's just a lot of people that are reframing the classic theme park experience or attraction experience. Interesting to follow how that's going to evolve.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's amazing that you're seeing you know, established attractions looking at how can they get additional revenue out of those spaces. But in addition to those extra charges, it's also like, how can we broaden that guest demographic? And the museum one was really interesting to me because I never would have thought like, oh, wow, you could do fitness classes in an art gallery. Mm-hmm. And that's really compelling. And it just made me think like, how many other ideas are out there that might seem a little crazy in a brainstorming session, but can be, you know, really powerful and successful for the right attraction.
Yeah. Well, and you look at like the 5K runs too that go through Disney. I mean, those are now a huge thing. Queen Mary's experimented with stuff like that. It's crazy. The last hit I wanted to put in here is about Facebook testing new labels for branded content partnerships. It's not officially been rolled out yet, I don't believe, but they've been testing new labels for branded content. Again, still trying to deal with the reactions from the political craziness and people not knowing what's ads and what's paid for and what's what. So just an interesting thing to be following before we head into our main topic of evaluating sponsorship opportunities.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear your take on this main topic. This is something you do all the time when you're looking at, you know, how to make Gantam, you know, stand out in the market, like what conventions to go to, what partners to work with, what sponsorship opportunities to do. I mean, you have a lot more expertise in this than I do. So I'm interested to learn from you. So do you want to kind of kick it off?
So I wrote down a few talking notes just very briefly to go through, and we can go through them. And I have examples, of course, a lot of different crazy examples because we do a lot of different kinds of sponsorships and partnerships with people. Before we all get even too deep into the talking points, I want to just point out one of the main differences here, and Brad will kind of appreciate this. The first thing is really to think about an overall strategy. Like, are you in mass marketing or are you really doing targeted items? So like if the market you're looking to do just saturate it, and you're at that level where you can pay for that mass marketing approach, then, you know, your whole working through this, your whole evaluation will be a little different because you know you're more looking for that just name and brand exposure versus if you're trying to do like individual sales, you're working on a smaller segment of it, or it's a pool that is too big really for you to saturate to that level, and you're doing more direct selling. Gantam, you know, we're looking at being in the larger themed entertainment or architectural space, and we're not a large manufacturer in that context. So we're looking really for those direct sales. So we have to get a little creative, and that's kind of why we bring some of this stuff up. And if you flip it though to the Halloween segment, we can do a little more mass marketing. So you kind of have to, before you even get into this, kind of think on that. And I'm sure Brad, having experience on both ends of those, you know, you understand what that translates it to basically is, for the most part, sponsorships, you know, they bring you like, here's our media kit and here's our packages, and, you know, just pay money and you put your logo somewhere. And like, I don't ever like to do that. But that's also because Gantam, that doesn't help Gantam because we're not really in that kind of mass market play. So I always have to look for different opportunities or move the opportunities around. But that's something that depends on your market. I'm sure that you guys have done stuff like that before, where you've done sponsorships and you've just done like a logo play or just like a branding play for recognition's sake.
Definitely. Yeah. And I mean, to your point, you know, at Knott's, you're trying to reach millions and millions of guests. So you do a lot more mass market stuff, and you have to, you don't have to, but there's only so many opportunities to reach people through digital marketing. And so when you're looking to reach millions of people, that's when you go into more of the traditional marketing like TV, radio, sponsorship opportunities. And those aren't always, you're not always able to track them, you know, one-to-one. But I think there is, you know, at that level, there is a reason to get your brand out there and your logo out there. And because you, you know, you're competing with a Disneyland, a Six Flags. And so you want to make sure that your brand is out there as much as your competitors are, or as, at least as much as your marketing budget can afford. Now on the flip side is, you know, on smaller attractions, that doesn't necessarily make as much sense to pursue some of those opportunities like that, that are really just, I'm just sticking my logo on something. And I know that's something that you're always fighting with, because there's so many sponsorship opportunities out there. I mean, I would probably get at least 2 to 3 a week at Knott's, if not more, from everything, from different, you know, universities to sports to conventions. And there's a lot of noise out there, and sometimes it's hard to cut through it.
So I wanted to kind of get that set straight at the top, just, you know, so people are understanding like what mindset you're working under. And Brad illustrated it perfectly, depending on those. But even so, even if you are in that mess, you know, marketing game, you, like Brad said, you're still getting pitched all the time if you're at that level. So I'm going to go through a little bit of a checklist that we go through. And I have some examples we can go through. The first section of it is really just, are you vetting them properly? First step. Some of these you'll notice are pretty sort of similar to hiring. Your first vet is the media kit they're giving you. That's sort of like a resume. You know, are they giving you real numbers, and are they letting you know transparently what their distribution is? I always get leery of shows, magazines, you know, trade shows or magazines, or even radio, or any of these people that come to and they don't have any like credible numbers, or they're like, they use adjectives like largest or premier or things like that, and they don't tell you the actual numbers. Or, you know, if their marketing is weak from the get-go, it's not a good sign. And as a marketing professional, you know, you should be able to evaluate that. Like, do they have a very clear understanding of who exactly their audience is and what they do to serve them? And can they communicate it? And do they have real numbers to back it up? I'd rather go with that, honestly, than I would with someone that has, you know, I'd rather go with someone that gives me all that straight up so we can make an informed decision than somebody who maybe has more, but that it's all kind of, you know, shady or whatnot. Because you always see stuff where they're like, oh, you know, we get 8,000, 16,000, whatever, all these attendees. You're like, well, what do you mean by an attendee? You know, did you have anyone audit those numbers? Did you actually check? And with magazines, you know, what are their actual subscriber numbers? How many and where do they distribute their stuff out to? What countries do they reach? You know, all that kind of stuff. Getting the real numbers in there is very important to me, looking at a media kit. Like, if they give you the details of exactly what the content is and where it's going. And then the next place I look, being like a media guy, is the website. Is their website, you know, is it updated? Is it responsive? Do they have good meta descriptions on their pages? You know, do they have sitemaps, privacy policies? Like, do they have trackers? You know, what, like, kind of like the way I look at it, and maybe this is a weird lens, but like, if you are hiring these people or doing a partnership with people to market on your behalf, you have to make sure they're actually good at marketing. And part of that is everything we talk about here on the show. Like, do they have a good message? Do they have good calls to action? You know, is their site updated? Is it responsive? Do they have good tagging? Because on the flip side, if they do content with you and it doesn't have any of those optimizations in it, then it's not going to really serve you good at all. So I always check all that information. And it depends, you know, if it's a, it just depends. If it's a trade show website, you know, I'm looking for it to be updated, but doesn't have to be as critical on some of these things. But if it's a media brand, I'm really pretty strict on making sure they check all the boxes. Then the next thing I look at is their social presence. And we talked about this before, but it's the same type of principle that we use for evaluating influencers. They may have a lot of followers, but do they post regular content that is useful content, like useful as in, could you see your brand fitting in with that content and actually getting value out of it? And is it are people reacting and having conversations, or are they just, you know, paying? And now you can look into what kind of ads they're running. You can look at their creative and figuring out what kind of ads they do. You know, you're vetting them from that standpoint as well. Their whole performance online. And another, you know, kind of question to ask yourself is, if you're partnering with them for any sort of social component, would your content make sense in their feed? And based on the content that's performing well on their page, is your stuff going to perform well on their page? Like, does it fit? You know, for example, if it's like what's on my mind, if it's like a Halloween fan page, you know, what types of Halloween fans are those, and what posts are they getting excited about? You know, is it how to, or is it shopping, or is it costumes, or is it makeup, or, you know, what is it? And do you fit within that context so that it'll actually be useful to them? Again, you know, the people should know this, but you kind of want to do a little bit of background research. The last thing on the vetting is referrals. I'm pretty, just like with hiring, you know, do they have a list of clients, and did you actually call and talk to any of the clients or any of the people to see what working with them was like? Did they do a good job? Did they not? You know, referrals tell you a lot. Really, they do. Even from a, like a drama background. Drama, when I say, like, how easy was their team to work with? Those types of things, you know, you can't really find out from their pitch decks. And sometimes I will say I've kind of been shown, kind of been on these, especially in other countries where media is different. And I've kind of done this pre-vetting check and I've not been impressed by a few people. Then I did their referrals check and I got back stuff like, that's the one party that everybody goes to. And, you know, if you're not there, it's an issue, you know, and I'm like, oh, well, well, you know, if you get those kind of things, and then you can kind of reevaluate. But I would, you know, those things you really have to know from their other clients. I'll run through these and we can do a recap at the end. But after vetting, then it's make sure they truly reach the market that you're targeting with this. If you're doing, you know, like we all have multiple markets that we're targeting, but are you, when you're looking at one of these partnerships, you should be picking one market, and then you should look at it and figure out, do these people actually hit that market that we look at? Going back to some of the examples that we, from our standpoint, you know, there's some magazines that do architectural lighting. Well, we don't, and they think there's crossover because we have an architectural line, but our focus isn't there. And the people that really I need to be reading about our stuff is influencers from the LED and controls side. So there's not quite that good pairing there. You know, those people read a different magazine for what they're looking for. And I know that because, you know, I asked to them and I look to see what they're doing. And where they're getting their information. So the next thing here, after you match that up, is making sure, since you have the one market you're looking on for this, that you've really focused your call to action and you've simplified those steps. I see this get messed up all the time, and I see it, I think, because on the flip side, I've sold sponsorships too. I see people get this kind of worked around. It's just like we talk about here with making sure that your regular call to actions are very laser pointed. You know, understand why you're doing the partnership and what you're trying to get out of it, so that it's all laser focused. When you're focusing on the call to action and simplifying the steps to make the audience take that, there's a few things, a few examples we have. So with in the Halloween market, you know, there's a lot of the fan shows that ask us and whatnot. So the call to action for there can get kind of blurry, because it's like, is a call to action that you're supposed to be purchasing the item, or just to know about the brand, or what, you know, what is the purpose of that? And another one we get to is just putting our logo places. but we don't sell direct. So some of the shows that come to us and ask us to do these sponsorships, you know, they have packages where they want logo placement or they want, you know, editorial or news or that kind of a thing. But us not selling direct, it makes that kind of not as useful because there's not a clear call to action there. You know, if you see the logo or you see this this news update, what is the action that the person who's seen that you're paying for, what are they supposed to take? So versus if we flip it around and say, you know, we're going to sponsor, you know, a tech design troupe to go and enter a competition. We did this in Switzerland. You know, we sponsored a team of student designers to go to Switzerland, and we sponsored that by allowing these student designers to take lights with them and use the lights in their competition. You know, that, because there's a clear call to action there for us, is that here are the lights and here are designers that now have kind of worked with these lights and gotten worked into that. Next one I look at is make sure that it ties back to the why. We've already talked about that, but on a previous episode, but make sure it ties back to the why of what you're accomplishing overall with your marketing plan and your strategy for this market that you're targeting. You know, is again, going back a few of those examples, you know, is the why to make them aware of it, or is it to sell tickets, or is it direct purchasing, or is it an influencer play? You know, are you trying to win over early adopters, or are you trying to bring it into mass? You know, what are you trying to do? And the last one here I have is don't assume that just because. So the other thing too is from working on this angle and trying to sell sponsors as well. Like, what's in the sponsor kit is never the entire sponsor kit. It's kind of like the. I don't want to say it's a lazy thing, but it's the options that that person has thought of. But if they're a good partner or a good someone to sponsor or a good partner for you in the future, there's probably a way for you to figure out a custom sponsorship or something outside of what they're offering, if what they're offering doesn't make sense to you. An example of that is the Halloween party show in New Orleans that we do in January. It's a show that on the front of it, you know, some of their opportunities are not as useful to us because it's mainly for wholesale retail, and they we have a retail brand, but it's not the right market for that retail brand, so that's kind of a miss there on a lot of their stuff. But you know, we can sit down with their VP of marketing and come up with a better idea for what to do. And one of those ideas to do is to partner to put together a main stage presentation, you know, partner to get the people they need, the influencers they need, and also influencers that we need to have more of a conversation with and have an opportunity to introduce them to our brand. So it's more of a direct sell play. So we kind of took their main offering, which was mass marketing, and you adjusted into, is there a way for us to still add value or to do something, but can we switch it into more of a direct play? Because we're really only interested in, you know, these 10 people that are coming to the show. So that was a lot. So Brad, what, I put the notes here, but Brad, what do you think? Am I rambling?
I think you covered everything I was going to cover.
Dang it. I should let you take some of these.
I was hoping you were going to forget about the referrals, because I think everything you mentioned is really important, but the referrals is really key. A lot of times if you ask for a referral and there's silence, either, you know, you don't get that email for a day or two, or there's silence on the other end of the phone, that's usually a big warning sign that they don't have... either they're new, they don't have a great reputation, or, you know, they just haven't thought about that question before, which are all really not
good
signs. No,
it's weird. But when you think about it, where you're like, you have to put your brain outside of it and say, if I were on this marketing team, like if I were working for these guys and I was on their marketing team, what would I do? Like, where are the holes? You know, like, and then you got to think of it. Well, if they have these holes that are that transparent, you know, they're not even bothering to get referrals, then is that going to be good for them? You know, quasi marketing my brand through sponsorship. You know, are we actually going to get value out of that? You know,
Yeah. And I try to find, and you touched on this a little bit, but I just wanted to reiterate how, I try to look for partners who are excited to work, with your attraction or whatever company you are.
Oh, yes. That's not very just important. For money,
but sometimes it's hard to put into words about like, what is that excitement? But I feel like, it when you see it from someone. It's not that they're like leading with, here's my press kit, here's how much everything is, but hey, you know what? I think this would make a lot of sense for your brand. These are the options I think would work best for you. As you mentioned, everyone's flexible. A lot of the sponsorship opportunities are always flexible, but I always love partners who are like, hey, this is what I think would work for you. Let me know if it doesn't. And I just want to find a way to work with, your park, your attraction, whatever it is. And I think when there's excitement and passion on both sides, those are the partnerships that tend to really work well. And, at Knott's, it was very much, Food Beast was a great partner to work with. They were always coming up with, okay, how are we going to find something that excites both of our audiences, that works for both of us? Let's figure that out first, and then we'll kind of figure out the money thing second. And I always appreciated that. Another really good partner was Crypt TV that we did a partnership with last year at Scary Farm. It was the same type of thing. It wasn't like, hey, here's how much things cost. Yeah. Pick one or whatever it was. Let's figure out what do you want? What do we want? Let's really come together and think about this. And I always ask partners to brainstorm and, pitch me on a few different ideas. And if they're not willing to do that, it's not going to be a good partnership.
If they're like
a little bit of work in the beginning.
Yeah. If they're like, well, everything is already written down in the sponsor kit. And you're like,
it's like, oh, they don't care about my business either. They don't need it. They don't care about it. They're just looking to make a quick buck and not have that lasting partnership.
Yeah. And there's a mindset that I think spells it out when you said about whether or not the team's excited or not. I'm missing the book where this came from. Maybe Brad, you'll maybe know, but it basically, I think it's from Decisive, and it's like, do you have the problem mindset or do you have the potential mindset? And I like thinking about that mindset because you can, when you frame it like that, you can pretty clearly see it. When you're bringing these opportunities, do they have all these problems with it, or are they focusing on the potential? Like, here's the potential we're trying to get to, this new type of arrangement that, we've never done before. We're going to do a video with Crypt TV where we're going to like do this crazy, zombie dance, random thing. Right. And they've never done this before. So are they poking all the problems into it, or are they like, we're really excited about that. It's going to be great to get this. Now, here are some of the things we got to work through, but we can work through them. What angle are they coming from? If they're coming from a problem angle, it's going to be very hard to kind of win them back over to seeing the vision of it.
Yeah. And that's only going to continue once you sign that deal.
Yeah. It's going to get worse. Yeah.
To borrow from I'm pretty sure this is a Walt Disney quote, or not really a quote, but Buzz Price would always say when he was working with Walt Disney that Walt always wanted a yes if person. So not a, hey, can you do this? Yes if, not a no.
Yeah.
Not a no because. And that's, I think about that all the time. I mean, when it comes to all different types of business, but especially partnerships, because if they're giving you that no when you are that early in the process, whew, good luck. I've worked on a lot of bad partnerships, and usually there were those telltale signs in the beginning. And and it's like a gut thing too. If you're just not feeling it, don't push it. There's so many opportunities.
Yeah. Yes.
Especially for smaller attractions. Like,
yes.
If there's a bad, if I made a bad deal or picked the wrong partner at Knott's, like, I was never happy about it. And I tried to learn from my mistakes and all of my jobs. But, when you're working on that big of a budget, it's not going to, doom your season or whatever event you're trying to launch. Whereas for a smaller attraction, when that's 20-30% of your budget or whatever it is, those decisions matter a lot. So if it just doesn't feel right, move on. Really try to listen to your guts. I mean, go through all the steps Philip mentioned as well, but there, I think there is that, there's that gut feeling, that excitement, that passion that is sort of that you know, kind of tertiary consideration when you're working with people.
All right. Well, I think we've rambled on long enough about about sponsorship opportunities.
Yes, no, it's a great topic, and Philip and I were talking about, you know, before the show, like, we don't want to name any names or anything, but we both had really good partnerships, which I named a couple in the show, but there's also been, you know, some bad ones, and you're never gonna, you know, you're never gonna bat 1,000. So hopefully some of this advice will help you as you're thinking about sponsorship opportunities for your attraction. Philip, did you want to add anything else before we wrap up episode 20?
No, just the usual stuff. Our symposium is July 30th and in Long Beach. And there's a code in here for 30% off. And the next issue of the magazine comes out in September. Fingers crossed. fingers crossed on that one. I mean, it'll get out, but there's a lot of work to be done on our end. So yeah, we're working on those too. So get on the subscription list to that, or see us in Long Beach.
Yeah. And if they want to subscribe, what's the link?
MarketingYourAttraction.com if you want to subscribe to the podcast. And for the magazine, it's seasonalentertainmentsource.com, and all in the show notes. And give us some feedback on our fancy new website.
Awesome. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.